Folks, if I could break in again, I think it's probably a reasonable time to bring up our speakers for this evening. We are really, really excited about the duo that we have with us tonight. I'm going to introduce the first speaker, who will in turn introduce the second. And I get to introduce tonight Peter Stalybras, who probably is known to many of you, but if not, I think you'll be really interested in some of the things that I have to say about Peter. Peter, in turn, will introduce Brooke Palmieri, who, if you don't know, helped curate this wonderful exhibition that surrounds us tonight. I think the best way to describe Peter Stalybras is as a force of nature. He's also an extraordinary friend to the Penn Libraries. But when he's not befriending us or acting as one of Mother Nature's proxies, he is the Annenberg Professor in the Humanities and Professor of English and Comparative Literature here at Penn. For the last 14 years, he has directed the seminar in the History of Material Texts, which is held in the Lee Library up on this floor, primarily. And he co-edits the Material Text series for the Penn Press. He's been a Guggenheim Fellow, a Samuel Wanamaker Fellow at the Globe Theater in London, and a Dropsy Fellow at the Center for Advanced Judaic Studies. Among the many awards Peter's received over the course of his career have been the Ira Abrams Award and the Lindbach Award for Distinguished Teaching, again here at Penn. As I said, Peter founded this seminar on the history of material texts in 1994, and he's been meeting basically every week since, which is pretty amazing. And in doing so, has brought together academics, librarians, writers, artists, and anyone interested in books and other cultural technologies. His own books include Renaissance Clothing and the Materials of Memory, which he co-authored with his wife, Anne Rosalind Jones, which, by the way, won the James Russell Lowell Prize from the MLA in 2001. And the book that Martha mentioned earlier, Benjamin Franklin, Writer and Printer, which Peter wrote with James Green, and is based on an exhibition that they curated in Philadelphia. In 2006, the Penn Libraries were blessed by having Peter give the A.S.W. Rosenbach Lectures in Bibliography. And the book that is resulting from those three lectures, Printing for Manuscript, is supposed to be published sometime this year. Right, Peter? We have some issues with our Rosenbach Lecture speakers and their books getting published in a timely way. But I know Peter he's got plenty of time. The year's young. Yeah, Peter is currently working on a history of the book from wax tablets to e-books. And being at a place like Penn is probably pretty useful for writing such a book because we have some early examples of writing in the University of Museum, and then, of course, we have these extraordinary collections over here, so it's probably a wonderful playground for Peter. In 2007, Peter was elected to the American Philosophical Society, the first learned society in this country, and some would say the only learned society in this country, which was founded by Benjamin Franklin in 1743. What an extraordinary honor that must have been for Peter. And we're honored to have him here with us tonight. So please join me in welcoming Peter Stalybras.
I have to grab for my notes and hope they're there. Well, thanks very much, Carton. That was a very generous introduction. I'm very grateful for that. I'm going to come around here so I can see what we're looking at. I just want to begin by saying that I don't know how many of you know what a remarkable place Penn is. I mean, I've been here since 1986. It's the only university in the world, as far as I know, certainly in this country, certainly in Europe, where everybody, graduates, undergraduates, anyone, can work on any book in this library. That includes the first folio. I teach with Roger Chartier, who's just been elected to the Collège de France in France. He's probably the most important historian of the book in the world now. He's not allowed to look at such books, let alone touch them. So when he came here, he couldn't believe it. He literally could not believe in this seminar that we taught together that undergraduates are working on primary materials all the time. This exhibition, which Brooke Palmieri initiated, she was the initiate for this when she was a fellow here on the sixth floor, she's a junior undergraduate, came out of really a wonderful collaboration with many of the librarians here. So I want to just start by saying that I think what defines Penn for me is as a place of quite extraordinary collaboration between students, undergraduates, graduates, between faculty and librarians. And so I particularly want to acknowledge all the librarians here, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time, going through that, but I do want to say Lynn Farrington, John Pollock, Nancy Shawcross, and Dan Traister, particularly, have been very, very actively involved in the teaching of our students. So students are learning in hands-on ways. They're learning technologies, they're learning about reading practices, they're learning actually, even finally, we hope, in the future, how to make new kinds of paper, which I'll mention this evening, will actually come up. I aim to have some new kinds of paper, a form with me that is now being manufactured in Massachusetts, which came out of research that in a seminar that Brooke was involved in. It's erasable paper, first made in the 15th century. So what we're going to do is very quickly just go through some images, and we're putting together a combination of Philadelphia, which for me is the center of the universe, and I should say why. Philadelphia is the center of the universe. You may not know this, but there are more clay tablets. The origins of writing are more thoroughly studied at this university than anywhere else in the world. The Sumerian Dictionary Project, which comes out of the museum, and the museum was doing digs with the British Museum, and they have a spectacular collection. The only rival to our collection really now is the British Museum in clay tablets. And then you come through to the 20th century, where the first major computer was made in Philadelphia. And it's this combination, I think, that's been unbeatable, the combination of what is, to be honest, a small rare book collection. It doesn't begin to compare to Princeton's or Harvard's or Yale's. And yet it is more used, it is more actively used by the faculty, by the graduates, and by undergraduates than any of those collections. And I can guarantee that. I work at all those libraries, and I could tell you many horror stories about even a former colleague of mine being thrown out of Houghton Library because of looking at a book whilst I was looking at it. Two people cannot look at a book together. That's a law. So this does not happen here. On the sixth floor, although we have priceless treasures, including the first folio, which is next door at the moment, priceless treasures, anyone, any undergraduate, can work on that. And that goes for Philadelphia. It goes for the amazing collections we have at the Rosenbach, at the Library Company, the American Philosophical Society, the Free Library, which has an unrivaled collection of medieval manuscripts, not really sufficiently studied, and also, incidentally, another first folio marked up by an early reader, more interesting, in my view, than any other first folio, except for one, which is now in Japan. So what we're going to do today is very, very quickly run through some of the kinds of things that we do here on the sixth floor. And what we're trying to put together is three things. Really wonderful research. I'm going to introduce Brooke Palmieri, an undergraduate, who really has, I think, cracked what is a remarkable book. People have known about it, but it's the book by Francis Daniel Pastorius, who founded Germantown. And he left behind a book called The Beehive. It's a manuscript. Brooke says it's not difficult to read. I think it's difficult to read, so let's just say that. So if Brooke doesn't find it difficult to read, something must have gone right in her education. I don't know what it was, but I take no credit for that. But anyway, she has really understood this book, I think, in a way it's not been understood before, and understands its place in a long genealogy that goes from before Shakespeare, but through Shakespeare, to Franklin. And Franklin actually is drawing upon some of Pastorius's discoveries, which we'll mention in passing. So the first thing to say about the tradition we're talking about is the interactive nature of reading and writing, and that's why I start with this image. This is from
Comenius, perhaps one of the most famous children's books of the 17th century, learning, teaching people how to read Latin. And this is the way it's done all the way through. So it says, the student, whilst he readeth books, picketh all the best things out of them into his own manual. And this is the origin of all the great theories of writing in the Renaissance. This is how you go about writing. You pick out the best things. And how do you do it? I'm trying to show you. There we go. Oh, we've gone too fast now. Sorry. This technology. Here's an early example. Lego, the word Latin, legere rather, it means to gather and to read. The word poesy is the same word as posy, right? Poesy and posy are the same word. So it means to write poetry is to gather a posy. So how do you go about doing? You can actually see here this wonderful example. I think I've got a pointer somewhere. John, can you tell me where my pointer is? Do I have a pointer there or not? Looks like I've got a pointer there. Don't worry, I've got another pointer. Somewhere, I have my own pointer. I can actually go two-handed. Anyway, I hope you can see that in the margin this is Aristotle. It's actually a text where the plant is being pulled out. So this is active reading, a reader who's reading this and at the same time extracting from it plants. And if you go through this manuscript of Aristotle from the 14th century, what you'll see, I'm hoping that you'll see, oh, it's done it again. I'll get the hang of it eventually there. Here's a range of hands that go into the text and extract the plants. So here, and this item is my favorite hand, right on the margins of the book. It's about to disappear out of the book into the world. In other words, this is interactive reading at its most extreme. And this is really what fascinates me, this process. Now, as we move towards Pastorius, the crucial thing is that there's a very elaborate theory that's been worked out, and it's based upon the bee. The bee goes back to classical antiquity, and the bee becomes the model for how the student should work. So if you go down this side, the bee's work is to find the nectar in the flowers, is to gather nectar from the flowers, it's then to put the pollen into the correct cell of the honeycomb, and finally, to make honey. And that is systematically organized by the 16th century into a series of processes. The material support for finding the nectar in the flowers is books and their margins, what you're reading. And the technique is underlining, marginal marks, and notes. Gathering nectar from flowers is small erasable tablets, I'll come back to that, or waste books. Waste books were used by merchants. And they collected them what are called promiscuous notes. What they meant by promiscuous notes has nothing to do with sex, alas. It just has to do with the notion they're randomly collected. You collect them in any order. They're not sorted yet. The third stage is the crucial stage, putting the pollen to the correct cell of the honeycomb. This is Pastorius's beehive that we'll be looking at. It's a large commonplace book normally, and it's notes under their proper alphabetical headings. And finally, you make honey, which is the material support sheets are gathering, and you compose or write. So this is what we're going to be looking at very fast. So the first stage, what I'm going to go through, is show these processes in action. Here we have an example from a 17th century book. There are thousands of books like this. Hands, very, very common. These are called now manicules, a pompous word for complicated reasons. They used to be called, by printers, they're called fists. And these, which look to us like quotation marks, what these are the markers for commonplaces, so that how you mark the things you're going to extract. Hands and those marks are the typical ways. There are other ways, too. You can mark, as we've seen already, with flowers. You can gather flowers. Here is actually Hamlet, the first quarto of Hamlet, a text that no one reads anymore. They should, but they don't. It says, "Let not your clowns speak more than is set down. There be of them, as I can tell you, that will laugh themselves to set on some quantity of barren spectators to laugh with them." In the first quarto, and only in the first quarto, Hamlet goes on to tell a range of very bad jokes. And then you have some again that keeps one suit of jest as a man is known by one suit of apparel, and gentlemen quotes down his jest down in their tables before they come to the play, as thus, "Cannot you stay till I eat my porridge?" And "You owe me a quarter's wages," and "My coat wants a colison," and "Your beer is sour," blabbering with his lips and thus keeping in his syncopace of jests. This is nowhere else, no other text of Hamlet's in the first quarto. But what's interesting to me and crucial to this is these are the lines that no one reads anymore, that a reader has thought of the most interesting lines. they've put a little hand in the margin, they've underlined them. They don't know the word syncopate, so they've underlined that. These are the lines for them. And it's all about taking down jests into their tables. And I'll come back to the question, what are tables? And that's part of a project here that we began at Penn. Roger Chartier and my seminar were teaching Hamlet, and we just didn't understand a passage and didn't understand what it meant because the footnotes were not good. This is one of those famous passages in Hamlet. Remember thee, this is Hamlet talking to the ghost. Remember thee, I, thou poor ghost, whilst memory holds a seat in this distracted glow. Remember thee, yea, from the table of my memory I'll wipe away all trivial fond records, all sores of books, all forms, all precious past that youth and observation copied there. And thy commandment all alone shall live within the book and volume of my brain, unmixed with baser matter. I'm going to skip a bit, just two lines. Then my tables, meet it is I set it down, that one may smile and be a villain. And so the question we had, looking at these footnotes we had, is that no one seemed to know what the hell tables were. And yet it comes twice in this speech, yea, from the table of my memory. So the first thing is they're erasable. Yea, from the table of my memory, I'll wipe away all trivial fond records, all sores of books. And then it says later on, my tables, meet it as I set it down. Hamlet's got a stage prop. He's actually holding tables, and he writes down in it, he says it, my tables, meet it as I set it down. That one may smile, and be a villain. A famous commonplace, by the way. So, what are these tables? Well, I went to the Folger Library and discovered them. This is the tables. These are from, they started being produced in the 15th century. They're being imported into England. They're erasable notebooks. This is the erasable surface. And so this is the process in which you take down, in small erasable tables, promiscuous notes. This is not one of the most interesting ones. It's actually a recipe for how to cure glanders, which is a disease of horses. But you find sometimes more interesting stuff. And lots of these survive, but have been miscatalogued. So it's an example of miscatalogued. People didn't know what it was. They start always with printed material, writing tables. And then here in the calendar, this is the calendar for December. You can see Christmas down the bottom. It says, to make clean your tables, when they are written on, take a little piece of a sponge or linen cloth, being clean without any soil. Wet it in water and wring it hard, and wipe what you have written very lightly, and it will out. And within 1/4 hour, you may write in the same place again. Put not your leaves together, whilst they be very wet with wiping. The reason for this is, now we've been able to make it, we've found recipes and so on, we're actually able to make it. The surface, the erasable surface, you can write in it with ink, but mainly it was written on with a metal stylus. So you write in it with silver, soft metal, and it's erasable just by, you can actually use your own finger, lick your finger. But the crucial point is it's an erasable surface made with a mixture of gesso and glue. And so that's why you don't want to put your tables together, because they'll stick together when they're wet. And here's an example that I found that we got for the Folger Shakespeare Library now has it. This is the stylus you write with. That's the writing implement. And inside, it's an erasable notebook. And there are lots of these. We're beginning to catalog them and find them all over the world. Oh, sorry, I've gone too fast. So, how does the process work then to go back? I'm not doing this very well. There we go. So the third stage, after you've taken your notes, you need to organize them. This is a commonplace book organized under alphabetical headings. This is the moment where they put the pollen in the correct cell of the honeycomb, a large commonplace book. Notes under proper alphabetical headings. And in this commonplace book from the mid-17th century, what do we find under remember, or will remember, remembered, remember me, remember my, right? All these are the headings. While memory holds a seat in this distracted globe, remember thee, yea, from the table of my memory, I'll wipe away all trivial fond records that youth and observation copied there, and thy commandment all alone shall live within the book and volume of my brain. The H, there's an index at the back which tells you, of course this stands for Hamlet, but it tells you this all the way. Or here, which is from Henry VI, I'll note you in my book of memory. With H6 at the end. So this is the practice, a practice that Shakespeare himself was undoubtedly doing, as you'll see in a second. why we know he was doing this kind of practice. And here's a printed commonplace book from, again, 1655, of memory, remembrance, and oblivion. That's the topic heading on the previous page. And there's the speech, remember thee, I, thou poor ghost, and so on. So, let's see if I can get this to, I don't know why it's working so badly. So this is to lay out the same passage, printed commonplace book, manuscript commonplace book. And here a manuscript, this is quite different, I shoved it in because it's interesting. This is the Nursery Theatre in the 1670s, working with the First Folio, and these are cuts. So they're doing something quite different here. They're actually making cuts throughout the play to stage, to actually do a stage performance. Hamlet's much too long. So what was Shakespeare commonplacing? The answer is he was commonplacing his most famous speech, to be or not to be. This is a series of wonderful commonplaces. No one had put them together in the way he did, but it's still worth saying these are commonplaces. To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them. And there you can just see how many people had said to be or not to be before Shakespeare, right? Or here, in the mind to suffer, 1576, 1582, 1600, a sea of troubles all the way through, sleep of death. It's one of his greatest speeches, but also a speech stitched together out of the materials of his culture, out of his reading. And Shakespeare was one of the greatest readers of all time, in my view. He knew how to read and put his reading to use. And some of his reading went, this is another kind of reading he did, went into songs. And so this is from the Free Library's copy of the First Folio, one of the only ones marked up by an early reader. We know this handwriting was before 1670 because the binding can be dated to about 1670, and it's trimmed off the comments at the edges, so you can date the handwriting. It's hard to date otherwise. And it says, opposite this song, in Hamlet, among Surrey's sonnets, folio 72. So this is a reader reconstructing, you might say, how Shakespeare went about it. Or here, in The Tempest, Setebos, which is actually mentioned in the play, Caliban's mother, god of the cannibals, purchases pilgrimage, volume 1, page 33. So literally the reconstruction here by an early reader of Shakespeare's own reading. And at that point, I hand over to Brooke, who's going to take you now through how this whole tradition goes into Pastorius and his commonplace book here in Philadelphia, or Germany.
Yes, I have to say I'm responsible for the geographic shift from England to now Germantown, circa 1683, where we have Francis Daniel Pastorius actually coming over for the first time. And a friend of William Penn's, he was given a charter to found his own town, Germantown. And so along with the first German settlement, he set up shop. But the interesting thing about Pastorius, which qualified him for the position of founder, I think, was his excellent education in the German university systems and abroad in Europe. And so what you have is a highly intellectual European suddenly in this sort of isolated new world. And what you get from that, I think, is a proliferation of texts that he has to produce on his own, manuscripts. And what happens is, a lot happens. By 1690 and 1692, his sons are born. And this is where Francis, who had been the treasurer of Germantown, who had been a schoolmaster, who had been very interested in the pedagogical development of the community, shifts his scholarly know-how, that is to say, this process of incorporating the bee into a tradition of scholarship. He shifts it to concerns of lineage. Lineage of a new kind, lineage of his last will and testament, and passing his education as best he can, and his knowledge of seven languages, by the way, to his children. Here we go. So that being said, I suppose we should start at the very first page of The Beehive, which he begins in 1696. And this is the very first page. I'll maybe talk about later how this page wasn't, in fact, the first page he wrote, but the latest page of introduction that he added into the text, and that I'll read. For as much as our memory is not capable to retain all remarkable words, phrases, sentences, or matters of moment which we do hear and read, it becomes every good scholar to have a commonplace book, and therein to treasure up whatever deserves his notice, etc. And to the end that he may readily know both whither to dispose and insert each particular, or also where upon occasion to find the same again, etc., he ought to make himself an alphabetical index, like that of this beehive. Because the price of wisdom is above rubies, and cannot be valued with the precious onyx or sapphire, and to get understanding is rather to be chosen than silver and gold, etc. And then he quotes what he's actually commonplacing, which is scripture, Proverbs and Job. And so I guess I take this as a kind of mission statement for the hundreds of pages that follow, which if you go back into the Lee Library, you can see. What this statement puts forward is, in fact, the commonplace tradition, which Professor Stallybrass mentioned earlier, the notion of the beehive, which indeed goes back to classical antiquity, but one interesting qualifier, and that's the alphabetical index. That is, the concern that after Pastorius was to pass on and pass this down to his sons, who are expressly the heirs of this book, how are you to retrieve the information that he's leaving for them? I mean, a proliferation of knowledge and textual quotes is one thing, but what use is it if you can't retrieve things as you need them? And so the large qualifier on the beehive itself is that it takes issue with knowledge and its collection by really pressuring it in the indexical system that Pastorius uses. And so maybe switching to the next slide, you can see this. And this is one of also several title pages. Again, maybe I just added this as a kind of mission statement of sorts for what Pastorius is trying for. After I had collected two volumes of delightful proverbs, witty sentences, wise and godly sayings, comprising for the most part necessary and profitable caveats, advices, doctrines, and instructions, out of many authors of many minds and different opinions, not only in my mother tongue, but likewise in the Low Dutch, French, Italian, Latin, which books in quarto are still with me. For the better learning of English, and that my two sons, who probably will never attain understanding of the said languages, might hereafter have some of their father's steps, thereby to be guided to the same diligence and assiduity of picking the best out of good writings. I endeavored to spare times to make this present hive on a quire of fine paper which a friend of mine, Jacob Tellner, departing from Europe, did give me. And when all over filled with honeycombs, I was constrained to enlarge my hive with more coarser, homely, or homespun stuff of this country product. Thus I leave it for the perusing of those for whom it was contrived, in the first beginning thereof. Nevertheless, if any other besides them should happen to be benefited by these miscellanies, it will not sad but glad my heart. And so what you get here is a kind of nice little material connection to what Pastorius is doing, that is taking a European tradition, on European paper no less, bringing it to America and reworking it, perhaps in the coarser homespun stuff that he mentions, that is the paper production that would take place in early Pennsylvania. And what he's doing with that is, I think, coming up with a project that, while inclusive of the genealogy that precedes him, necessarily includes the genealogy that's to come after him, that is, his sons and, as he specifies, anyone else who can add into the book. So he's really marrying two notions of genealogy, to continue on that point, the scholarly and the familial. And this is bound up very closely with, as Professor Stallybrass mentioned, the tradition of the bee. And maybe to follow, see if we can't reconstruct what Pastorius wanted his heirs of the beehive to do, I thought I'd show perhaps this top image is an image of the first index that Pastorius writes. And if you can see, there's an entry that he directs you to for the bee. And what I have below is the actual entry for the bee. So instead of turning the pages, we can just sort of reconstruct it here. And what the entry says, or at least an excerpt, is, "A spider gathereth poison, where a bee would find honey. A bee chooseth rather to go to the flower in the field, and there to lay their thighs securely and with leisure, but a wasp comes to the apothecary's shop and falls into the honey and is drowned. So along with the bee metaphor that you have running here, he also takes time to sort of taxonomize insects as a larger metaphor of how you should read. That is to say, you have to choose rather to go to the flowers, that is, choose to go to the texts rather than just, say, steal them from someone else. Or, like the spider, you have to interpret texts and their extracts in the proper way, extract the right things from texts, unlike a spider, which only gathers poison. And this is just a neat little sort of educational device, I think, when you think of approaching children or anything with learning. Well, it's good to sort of give a kind of image to base his entire philosophy of organization of content on. And the bee does just that. And now this is an example actually that is newer to my attention. And I think it would it seems to me as if it is a promiscuous, an example of a promiscuous book, because what you have here are notes that Pastorius means to put into the beehive. And he says, of such phrases and sentences which in haste were booked down here before I had time to carry them to their respective proper places in my English folio beehive. So what you have is a kind of middleman between Pastorius's reading, his taking down of notes, and what he'd eventually like to put into his beehive. And this is actually something that comes up several times. A lot of his works, one of which is over in the Lee Library, that is The Young Country Clerk's Companion, is something that he even copies extensively into his beehive. So the beehive really is a master text, but in the meantime, you have all these little offshoots of the kind of work that he's trying to do with that. And so here, I mean, really, this is a lovely example of a kind of literal, physical commonplacing in that you have leaves being pressed into the pages. And it kind of illustrates, I suppose, what's happening intellectual when you interact with a book. Though it's worth saying that with something like the beehive, and even with something like pressing leaves in general, while you have a remnant of what it is you're taking, the result is something completely new and synthesized. There's the honey that you're adding something of your own into. So it's not a passive scholarship. It's very much active on all levels, even that of interpretation and reuse. And this, well, I always found this to be the most interesting looking page of the beehive, if slightly inscrutable. Really what it is just the use of the name Anna, a palindrome, several times repeated as a kind of, again, learning device. And really I think it just speaks to the extent to which Pastorius is obsessed with forms of storing and presenting information. And it's actually more of an exception to the rule of the kinds of things you find in the beehive, but an interesting one nonetheless. Finally, to give you a sense of some of the, as opposed to the Anna entry, some of the more normal insertion and construction of content in the beehive, what we have here are two excerpts. The first is from a section of the beehive known as Emblematical Recreations, and actually there's a story about Pastorius in a poem that a contemporary wrote that says, you know, he was obsessed with collecting lists of things from sayings on gravestones to his wife's handkerchiefs. He was always listing things, and Emblematical Recreations is really a list of things organized according to loosely related subjects, but the things come in the form of images that have made impressions on him, and what he does after he lists the image is he lists associations with that, sometimes in Latin, proverbs. It's commonplacing of another kind, but yet he distinguishes it from the commonplacing of mere excerpts. There's a kind of visual tradition that's being connected in this section, as opposed to later in the text. And so the one example from this that I picked out is, the Bible and my heart are never like to part. And this is under the books section. And this is actually something that Professor Stallybrass will talk about later, I'm sure, because it actually fits once again into education of minors. The Bible and my heart are never like to part comes from a way of learning the alphabet that was popular at the time, and you can see in the Lee Library in the New England Primers. And this is, again, something Pastorius was very interested in because he was a schoolmaster, and in fact he lost his job as treasurer of Germantown because he gave too much time as a schoolmaster that they didn't think he was diligent enough in his bookkeeping. And finally, in conclusion, to sort of make another leap to Franklin this time, I thought it would be worth noting that while Pastorius, I think, is a kind of epitomized form of the types of scholarly practices we've been talking about, he's also just one link in that chain, and a chain that gives, that leads to someone like Ben Franklin, who we are very familiar with. And in this case, I mean, you can both see that they're both thinking along the same lines, and that what you have here is early to bed, early to rise, makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. But at the same time, this sort of destabilizes the notion that Franklin was, in fact, responsible for all of these sayings that we attribute to him, because if you see, this is in Dutch beneath. So it's being imported, and imported in a time period before Franklin had even come to Philadelphia, because Pastorius dies in 1719. And I think that's a good transitional point. So thank you.
So I'm just going to conclude by saying a couple of very brief things about this whole tradition and Franklin. Two things just to pick up on. First of all, Franklin learned from Pastorius about making money. These leaf prints, which he found in a book in the library company, he actually then started using as a security device on money, because the veins, every leaf is unique with all its veins. So if he'd realized if he could reproduce it exactly, I seem to have lost my pointer. I don't know what.
Yeah, you can see the veins
are so unique. And what he would do when he printed money, Franklin would also send out proof sheets so you could actually, all around the country, you could test money as it came in against those proof sheets to see if it exactly matched. So this is something he learned from Pastorius. That's part of the technology of what he learned. He also learned just many of the sayings. But before we go there, this notion of the heart, the Bible in my heart, or in Hamlet, the notion of how you write things upon the book of the heart or the book of memory. This is a central conceit running through the Renaissance and being carried on, and becomes part of the American alphabet. So this is how you learn the American alphabet. My book and heart shall never part. Here I like it because the image changes. First of all, you get two things separately. Now you get my book and heart shall never part. Now the heart is on the book. And this is the last image. My book and heart must never part. Now the book is inside the heart. So this combination, you can see, you can change, you can ring the changes on these amazing images. How did Franklin actually go about doing what he wrote? He had a whole range of early books of proverbs that he collected. This is one of them, a collection of English proverbs in the Library Company's collection, where he gathered lots of his proverbs. An empty sack cannot stand upright. He's going to use that. But he again rings the changes for a very specific reason. He puts them in tiny spaces in his almanacs, and they have to fit in. So here you've got small space, an empty bag cannot stand upright. That's the space. Here he's got more space, so he expands it. 'Tis hard but glorious to be poor and honest. An empty sack can hardly stand upright. But if it does, 'tis a stout one. So he's actually filling up the space. He goes back and forth, or here in 1758, 'tis hard for an empty bag to stand upright, as poor Richard truly says. And finally, into his autobiography. And really where I want to end is with the notion of Franklin, as the great experimentalist he was, still working on new ways of interacting between texts and life. And here he is interacting with his famous table of virtues, which people forget he gave up on as a useless enterprise. He said it's better to be a speckled axe, meaning it's better to have some faults, which people often forget. But in the process, what he did do is he realized you need to learn a new technology. His notebook he made didn't work. And what he wrote, and this is what I'll end with, is he says, why it didn't work is kind of interesting. If I can find the passage. Yes, he says that this is it. So he originally made his notebook on paper, and he says, to avoid the trouble of renewing now and then my little book, which by scraping out the marks on the paper of old faults to make room for new ones in a new course became full of holes, I transferred my tables and precepts to the ivory leaves of a memorandum book on which the lines were drawn with red ink that made a durable stain. And on those lines, I marked my faults with a black lead pencil, which marks I could easily wipe out with a wet sponge. I always carried my little book with me. And so that's what his little book looked like. And anyone wants to look at them, this is what they look like. That's the size of them. This I got off eBay for $99. They're like fans, and they're erasable. You can write anything on them, and then you can erase it. And so this was a technology that Franklin, an ancient technology that was already being used in the Middle Ages, and I managed to get another one from a Scottish bookseller who just sent it to me out of the blue, because you get these people get passionate about collectors. So when they realize how passionate you are, you start gathering these little sequences. And Franklin was also experimenting with making erasable paper, just to bring things full circle. So that's where we conclude.
Peter and Brooke, are you prepared to take any questions from the crowd? If anybody has any questions for anybody, like to ask any questions? Well, if not, curators will be available if you want to spend some time in the Lee Library looking at material. Otherwise, the formal part of this evening is over. And again, I just want to thank you all for coming, and it was a terrific event. I'd like to thank Peter and Brooke again for a really great talk. And thanks for coming, and we hope we'll see you at the next Orrery Society event. So thanks again.